Okay, this week we're going to begin with chapter 7 of God's covenant with man. The first section sets before us a proposition that is important. It's something that's been mentioned in a number of different connections, but this is a principle of the Christian religion, which is possibly one of the most important for us to grasp in order that we keep ourselves in check when we're trying to think about things. When we're trying to think about God and what He's done. So let me read this, and then I'll talk about it a little bit. First, chapter 7, section 1. The distance between God and the creature is so great that although reasonable creatures do owe obedience unto Him as their Creator, yet they could never have any fruition of Him as their blessedness and reward, but by some voluntary condescension on God's part, which He hath been pleased to express by way of covenant. So, what do we see here? I think we see a couple of things. First of all, there's this idea of the distance between God and the creature. And right now, our concern with this idea of distance is focused primarily on God as He is Creator, the creature as He is created. This great gulf, this infinite gulf, this distance which is unbridgeable, has, by virtue of its existence, it does, in fact, and continues, in fact, to imply that we owe obedience to God as our Creator. But it does not in any way imply, nor should it be taken to imply, that God owes us anything. So as we talk about this, both in terms of creation and then later in terms of redemption, we add, as I've said in other contexts, we've added by reason of sin another infinite gulf, another area where there's this infinite distance, whereby we simply cannot approach unto God. And yet, the presence of this distance is the very thing which tells us that we are under this obligation. We owe obedience. That obedience is not an obedience that, in fact, bears any fruition. In other words, that gulf, that distance, whether we're talking about creation or redemption, that distance simply implies that we owe God, both as He's our Creator and as He is our Redeemer. In no case does it imply reward. In other words, by reason of creation, all men, before and after the fall, before and after grace, come under an obligation to obey. It's simply this: do this. Now, how then do we get to this point of blessedness, a reward? Well, there's a principle here that is called covenant. God, by way of covenant, voluntarily condescends. And covenant represents a voluntary condescension on the part of God. It's Him stooping down to our level, because we can't possibly mount up to His. covenant then is what adds this dimension of possibility of blessedness and reward. We're going to see that that holds true with what is called both the covenant of works and the covenant of grace. In the case of the covenant of works, the covenant of works is that part, do this and live. That "and live" is an expression of that covenant of works principle. It's a covenant principle. And live. That is, be blessed in me. Be fruitful in me. I am your great reward. There's no expectation of that simply by reason of creation. There's only by reason of creation an obligation of obedience. And that obligation of obedience we've talked about before, and we will talk about again. That obligation of obedience, whether under the covenant of works or the covenant of grace, is expressed in terms of the moral law, the natural moral law in particular. All right, the first question then, is the distance between God and the creature great? The answer is yes. It's great as to wisdom, power, and righteousness. Look at Isaiah 40 verses 13 to 17.
Isaiah 40 verses 13 to 17. Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor, hath taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed to him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing, and Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity.
All nations before him are nothing and less than nothing. This is what creation is to God, in comparison to God. Why is that? Well, there are a number of reasons why, really, if we consider the nature of the divine, the divinity, the deity, the divine nature itself is everything that creation is not: independent, self-existent, self-reliant, all-sufficient, eternal, immutable, or unchangeable. The creation doesn't participate in any of that, and so there's this gap, and this gap extends to all of these different characteristics of the divine nature, divine wisdom and power and righteousness. Necessarily follows that these things are all infinitely higher, eternally out of reach, if we consider simply the matter of creation. So if there's going to be any kind of point of contact, there's going to be any point at which there is a possibility of there being anything more than this obligation on the part of man. If there's going to be any possibility of reward, if there's going to be any possibility of man taking any kind of pleasure really at all in God, this requires what the Bible calls covenant. The gulf is that great. It's not simply, and this is a misconception that even some Reformed people have, it's not simply by reason of sin that covenant is necessary. Covenant is necessary for man to have any ability to participate in God, that is, to have any participation in that which is communicable of God, in a way that would be fruitful and blessed and a matter of reward. That can only happen by way of covenant. And the reason is there exists no relational point of contact by nature. That is to say, God and the creature are totally and absolutely distinct as to nature. Look at Job 9, 32 and 33.
Job 9, verses 32 and 33. For he is not a man as I am, that I should answer him, and we should come together in judgment. Neither is there any daysman betwixt us that might lay his hand upon us both.
There's no contact by nature. The divine nature is wholly different, wholly removed from the created nature, particularly the human nature. And then morally, there exists a great chasm between the righteous demands of God and the compliance of the creature. 1 Samuel 2:25.
1 Samuel 2, verse 25. If one man sin against another, the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against the Lord, who shall entreat for him? Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them.
So, the fact is this. God, between God and man, there is no natural point of connection. Man cannot establish that. There's no way that man can do this. There is, in fact, a point of connection. There is, in fact, a point at which, in the covenant of grace, God enters into a relational point of contact in Christ, by reason of the hypostatic union in the person of Christ, whereby the divine and the human natures are made to exist in one person, united in one person. There's a union there. But that's not, even that, we can't say is a point of contact by nature. That's a point of contact that is personal. In other words, the two natures actually don't connect. It's not that the divine and the human are connecting each other. They're connecting to the person of Christ. And so they have this point of union and communion that's personal. It's a personal union, but it's not a natural union. Because a natural union is an impossibility. The fact is that the created nature and the divine nature are wholly other. So they're never joined together. The only way then, and to this, as a note here, to this we've added the breach, the moral chasm of sin. But this gulf, this distance can only be bridged by what is called covenant. And that requires a voluntary condescension on the part of God. Because, again, we can't get up that high. We can't mount up to heaven to bring God down. But God, as he has proven in the person of Christ, is in fact able to come down from heaven. Now, that's our problem, that we have this great distance. In comparison to God, all of creation is nothing. When the creation itself compares itself with God, it should assess itself as nothing. So, there is great distance. And the way to achieve a bridge across that chasm is not to look for something natural, rather to look for something covenantal. It exists in this idea of covenant. And this idea of covenant, in the idea of covenant, we're saying that there's a voluntary condescension on the part of God. All right, the second question that we want to review a little bit is this. Although reasonable creatures owe obedience to the Creator, are they able to experience any blessedness or reward apart from the voluntary condescension of God? I've already answered that. The answer is no. The fact is this, that in order for the Lord even to behold the things of the earth, he must voluntarily condescend to look upon it. It's Psalm 113, 5 and 6.
Psalm 113, verses 5 and 6. Who is like unto the Lord our God, who dwelleth on high, who humbleth himself to behold things that are in heaven and in earth.
Yeah, he humbleth himself, the psalmist says, to behold things that pertain to the creation. That is, God must voluntarily condescend. He is condescending toward us. You know, a lot of people get upset when people, they feel that people are condescending toward them, but the fact is, the Bible everywhere presents God as condescending toward man. And if it were not for that, man would be in a state absolutely irretrievable, because of sin, but even at the creation, he would be in a state that would be unable to enter into that kind of fullness of communion with the Creator that was opened up by way of covenant. Man simply owed a debt of obedience. Why? Again, because God created him. Remember what Jesus says, that, you know, when you've done everything that you were supposed to do, you're still unprofitable. We'll come back to that in a moment. But the fact is, there's nothing that you have. There's nothing in the nature of the creation that could make a reciprocal demand. In other words, there is something in the nature of the Creator that places a demand, innate demand, upon the creation. But there is nothing. There's nothing at all upon that is part of the nature of man that can place this kind of demand upon God. Man simply can't demand that God do anything, or that God owes him anything. Reward for what? For doing simply what was required? You don't reward people for doing what was required. Right, therefore, it is with this knowledge, then, of the infinite superiority of God that men must approach him. Look at Psalm 100, verses 2 and 3.
Psalm 100, verses 2 and 3. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence with singing. Know ye that the Lord, he is God. It is he that hath made us, and not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture.
Yeah, we are the sheep of his pasture. Why? Because he made us. We didn't make ourselves. He made us. Who made God? No one. He simply is. He's self-existent. And in that, there is an inherent excellence. In that, there's an inherent superiority, which far exceeds any possible perfection or excellence that could be found in the creation. The creation, by its very nature, is dependent. The creation, by its very nature, is mutable. Creation, by its very nature, is not eternal. All of these things point to, then, this vast distance. there's a natural distance, and that natural distance implies all kinds of qualitative as well as quantitative gulfs, infinite gulfs between the divine and the human. And so, in the equation, because God has made us, everything in the equation is on the side of God. Every due, every right, every prerogative. There's nothing on the side of the creation. God, simply by being the creator, is owed. That which is dependent inherently owes that upon which it has depended. Simply the way things are. Because of that relation, because it's not a relation of equals, but of a superior and an inferior that is so inferior, it's hardly worth even being counted in the equation, that inferior can't possibly place any demand or can't possibly come to this relation even of creator and creation with any expectation. Because there is no place for that. It's so unequal. The distance is so great that if God himself does not intervene by way of covenant in this voluntary condescension, if he doesn't do something here, then the creature will exist wholly in a state of utter dependence and owing without any prospect of any reward or any fruit of blessedness, any kind of hope of something more or greater than what's in front of you, what is in front of you at any given point. There really isn't any hope beyond being in a situation which demands constant, total, absolute obedience to the Creator. And you do it all, and from a creator creation point of view, we're all involved in a thankless job. The idea that God would condescend, voluntarily condescend, so as to put himself in a position where he would actually thank us, in a sense, that is, reward us for doing what we already owed, that's an incredible thought, and yet that's exactly what the Bible is telling us. There's nothing in a man that can profit God. Look at Job 22, 2 and 3, and 35, 7 and 8.
Job 22, verses 2 and 3. Can a man be profitable unto God, as he that is wise may be profitable unto himself? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty that thou art righteous, or is it gain to him that thou makest thy ways perfect?
Job 35, 7 and 8. If thou be righteous, what givest thou him? Or what receiveth he of thine hand? Thy wickedness may hurt a man as thou art, and thy righteousness may profit the Son of God.
The fact is this: whether you obey or disobey doesn't harm God. That's a fact. You owe him. And by reason of that natural obligation, all men are liable to eternal punishment. But the fact is, there really isn't any upside because you're never profiting God. God, why does God need to reward you? He gave you your life. He gave you everything you have. You didn't deserve any of that anyway. There's nothing in you. Everything that you already have is proof of your obligation. It's not, in fact, any expression of a right or an entitlement that you have to approach God and make any demands upon Him. Just simply isn't there. It's not there naturally. Again, even when men have done everything commanded, they've only performed that which was due to God as their creator. Look at Luke 17:10 and Acts 17:24 and 25.
Luke 17, verse 10. So likewise ye, when ye shall have done all those things that are commanded you, say, we are profitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do.
Acts 17, verses 24 and 25. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things.
Your obedience, even though you owe it, it does nothing for him. You're not getting anywhere with God. People who think that they're going to get somewhere with God by doing good entirely misunderstand the relation between the Creator and the creation. Let alone what's happened with respect to that relation by reason of sin. That wasn't even possible before sin. And we're really trying to keep our minds right now focused on a world without sin. Sin is just going to complicate this picture more. It's not going to help. But given the state of being an unfallen being, all of your obedience still is profiting God not one whit, and there's no reason to reward you for it. You know, you could work from now to eternity, and you still wouldn't repay the least bit of what you're owed simply for having existence. That's something you couldn't do. You're not self-existent. You're utterly dependent. Right, there is no blessing or reward due unto any man except that God condescend of his own free mercy to bestow such upon the sons of men. This is, I think, one of the things Paul alludes to in 1 Corinthians 4, 7.
1 Corinthians 4, verse 7. For who maketh thee to differ from another? And what hast thou that thou didst not receive? Now, if thou didst receive it, why dost thou glory as if thou hadst not received it?
Very interesting question. Why dost thou glory if thou hast not received it? Answer, you shouldn't. What you have simply by the free condescension of God. So it really raises that question then of why? Why does... What is it? Why is God doing this? Well, God, if God didn't do this, we certainly couldn't be blessed. And because, and this is what is so incredible, when we think about this idea of covenant, because covenant really in no way profits God. The fact is that God has, and this is again why it's voluntary, not necessary. God has voluntarily condescended, nonetheless, to covenant for the benefit of man. Yeah.
Could you then say that God covenants, he has restricted himself?
Yes. God is voluntarily restricting himself because he's voluntarily, in fact, bound himself now to reward certain things. He's basically promised something. The reason, you know, covenant is always bound up with promise is because ultimately it's not deserved. And we'll see that even when we get to the what we call the covenant of works. We may tend to think of it as works-oriented. But the reward really is not something which comports with the requirement. It's still a matter, there's a gracious element there in what happens. There's still something going on that clearly demonstrates it's a matter of covenant or voluntary condescension because God is going to reward. He's promising a reward. There's no merit there. There's no real merit. You can't, from where we are, you can't possibly work yourself up to deserving communion with God, union with the divine nature, that is, in the sense of participating in the communicable attributes of God and all that's entailed in eternal blessedness. There's no way that you could ever command that of God if God didn't first promise that. And in promising that, the way he promises it, the way he binds it to us, is, and the way he binds himself is by way of what we call covenant. So, that really is question three. In what way has God expressed himself so as to display his voluntary condescension, bestowing blessings and rewards? And the answer, as I said, is by way of covenant. God has all along exercised his providence towards men in order to make them happier and render their obedience more cheerful. Psalm 25:14.
Psalm 25:14. The secret of the Lord is with them that fear him, and he will show them his covenant.
He'll show them his covenant. God does this, you know, again, not for his benefit, but for ours. And so in covenanting with man, God is demonstrating to us that he is a beneficent God. He's not simply to be feared and obeyed, but he's to be feared and obeyed because he is a good God who is, in fact, he is taking a position, if you will, of beneficence toward his creation. He is going to be generous and be the benefactor of the creation. He doesn't have to do that. You know, he very well could have done what the deists assert he did, which is create and just walk away, as it were. Just leave it go. See how all that mess is going to turn out. You know, deism presents a very different God. And people who deny this idea of covenant have a very different view of God. They either tend to view God in terms which ultimately, because of the introduction of sin, ultimately find expression in Pelagian notions and other metaphysical unrealities with respect to God, where they change the nature of the Godhead into something that they can comprehend and understand. They do that because they don't see this great distance. They actually think that in some respect they can comprehend the deity. And one of the more common ways that people do that is when they say, I don't, you know, my God isn't like that, or my God wouldn't do that, or my God, you know, God would never, any God that would do this, I would never worship, and so on. There's all kinds of stupid talk that people have. People who talk that way don't even have a proper conception of this distance between the Creator and the creation. It's just foolishness. They think that they are in a position to define what's right and wrong, good and evil, and so on. And this is exactly what was promised to Adam and Eve when they ate the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The fact that so many people fall into this is proof not of the fact that we are able to somehow touch the divine nature with our nature, but rather it's proof, I think, of original sin, which we've already talked about. Anyway, God expresses himself then by this voluntary condescension by way of covenant. And that really begs this next question, right? What is it that we mean by the term covenant? What's meant by that term? How should we understand that? What is covenant? Well, I think we need to look at several passages and consider as well some of the things which are held forth to us in the Bible with respect to this, so that we can gain a little bit of an understanding of this idea of covenant. So we'll begin with the Hebrew word for covenant. The Hebrew word for covenant is berith. And berith actually denotes an establishment in general, the establishing of something. And that's why we read, for example, of God's covenant with day and night in Jeremiah 33:25.
Thus saith the Lord, if my covenant be not with day and night, and if I have not appointed the ordinances of heaven and earth.
God in covenant then is establishing something. There's an establishment going on. Something which was not there by nature is being established, in fact, by a voluntary condescension. And that voluntary condescension is revealed to us through words. We can learn a little bit, I think, about the word berith if we think about it this way. It's actually... there are some people who would like to derive it from bara, which it means to create. But it's more consistent with the nature of language, the Hebrew language in particular, that we see it not so much as a derivative of bara, to create, as it is of bara, which means to elect. So instead of an aleph, Beit Resh Aleph, we're looking for a Beit Resh He, Bara. That means to elect, because in a covenant, there's a selection or even a commissioning of persons and conditions. That's what's going on in a covenant. There's establishing of what we might now call ground rules. There's both a selecting in a covenant, there's a selecting of the persons, there's a definition of who is it, who is taken into this covenant. You know, that has to be defined. So there's that selection or commissioning. There's also then the conditions of that covenant, that establishment. There are conditions which are set. We know that in Scripture, it was customary to dedicate and confirm such a covenant with various ceremonies, to which also belonged the slaughter of animals. In fact, there was a peculiar way in which the animals were slaughtered. These animals that were used in the ordinance of covenanting originally were cut in half. And the pieces would be placed opposite to each other. And then it would proceed in this way. The parties that were covenanting were supposed to walk between these pieces of the animal that was divided. And they were testifying in this way that if I break this covenant, I need to be cut in pieces, torn asunder. We see this when we look at Genesis 15, 9 and 10.
Genesis 15, verses 9 and 10. And he said unto him, take me an heifer of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he took unto him all these, and divided them in the midst, and laid each piece one against another. But the birds divided he not.
And we also see this in Jeremiah 34, 18 and 20.
Jeremiah 34, verse 18. And I will give the men that have transgressed my covenant, which have not performed the words of the covenant which they had made before me, and they cut the calf in twain, and passed between the parts of them. Verse 20. I will even give them into the hand of their enemies, and into the hand of them that seek their life, and their dead bodies shall be for meat unto the fowls of the heaven, and to the beasts of the earth.
Okay, so the passing between. We saw it when God made the covenant with Abraham. We see Jeremiah alluding to this idea of passing through the midst of these animals when they're divided. Why do we do this? Why was this part of the covenanting? Well, again, covenant is bringing together two or more parties. Not by way of a natural conjunction, but by way of a condescension, particularly on the part of the superior party. There is a grant that's being recognized here, and the idea that if you break covenant, it's like splitting this animal. These are two things that have been joined together. You know, in the conception of an animal, there's a male and a female that are both contributing to this being. In a breaking of covenant, it's almost like ripping apart that body which has been conjoined. Now, we actually see this in the New Testament. When Judas, in fact, betrays Christ, he goes out, and in the Gospels it says he hanged himself. But in Acts it says that he fell down and burst asunder in the midst. That is, his body, in fact, burst apart like these animals were ripped apart. That was a sign of the fact that he was a covenant breaker. He broke covenant with God, and God literally ripped his body in half. Yeah.
Do you mean ripped it in half as far as like from the head, like in the midsection?
In the midsection.
Or like from the right side to the left?
No, I think the midsection.
Okay.
In Acts it says he fell down and burst asunder in the midst. You know, it, somewhere in his midsection he blew apart. That's just part of being a covenant breaker. The thing that resulted from the joining together of the two parties or the other parties in the covenant, that's been destroyed. So the fruit of that is being destroyed. The fact is that man's peace with God, his ability to find blessedness and fruition in God and with God, that's been destroyed in covenant breaking. And so the two things that have been joined together are being ripped apart. They're being halved. And you can see that the end of all of that isn't good for the covenant breaker. God isn't the one who's going to be breaking covenant. Although, in Christ, as we'll see, again, what did he do? He took upon himself the nature of man, and he died for man as a covenant breaker. And Christ himself is split in two with a spear. Drive a spear into his side. And the water and the blood pour out. He's showing us in that idea of a broken covenant. He's paying the price for that. So that there's that division. These things are all put back together in the covenant of grace. The things that are ripped apart in a broken covenant of works. But if we want to understand the nature of covenant, it has to do with this idea of selecting and defining, you know, commissioning persons, conditions, things which wouldn't necessarily find a natural point of contact. And certainly when we're talking about God, there is no natural point of contact. So this language then of the cutting of the animals and you know, tearing them apart and walking between, this is why when we talk about covenanting in Hebrew, we're said to kerath berith, that is to cut a covenant. See this, for example, in Psalm 50, verse 5.
Psalm 50, verse 5. Gather my saints together unto me, those that have made a covenant with me by sacrifice.
Yeah, those that made a covenant with me by sacrifice. That is, they've cut a covenant by sacrifice. All that sacrificial killing of the animals in the Old Testament, those animals are all being cut to represent the breaking of the covenant every time we sin. They're being ripped apart to make an atonement for sin. You know, there has to be an atonement when there's been a breach of covenant. There has to be a way of fixing that. And that way of fixing that is atonement. So there's a cutting of the covenant when there is, in fact, a recognizing, a selecting, defining of the parties, as well as an establishing of the conditions. There's demonstrations, very demonstrative in the ancient world. It was very demonstrative. You would know exactly what was going to happen to you. Just in case you weren't clear, that animal was being ripped apart to show you this is what you deserve. This is what's coming to you. This is what you've owned if you break covenant. So, it's called cutting covenant. And not because we're cutting ourselves per se, although we're making ourselves liable to that. The heathen cut covenant and tend to do that in their own blood. The fact is that this is being done in the blood of another. Again, all of this is going to is typical and pointing in some respects to what Christ is going to do. Nonetheless, it's called cutting of a covenant. In the Latin, vercutir, fetus, that is to cut a covenant. It was also customary at that time to eat a meal in conjunction with the act of covenanting. Genesis 31, 44 to 46.
Genesis 31, 44 to 46. Now therefore come thou, let us make a covenant, I and thou, and let it be for a witness between me and thee. And Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar. And Jacob said unto his brethren, gather stones. And they took stones and made an heap, and they did eat there upon the heap.
Yeah, they ate upon the heap. There's an eating that goes along with it. That's part of cutting the covenant. And it was for this purpose, in fact, that salt was used, which is pure and stable and keeps food from spoiling. We still we still in some places preserve meat by salting it. If you salt something, it prevents spoiling. So this is probably the reason why a sure and desirable covenant is called a covenant of salt, such as you see in 2 Chronicles 13:5.
2 Chronicles 13:5. Are ye not to know that the Lord God of Israel gave the kingdom over to Israel, to David forever, even to him and to his sons, by a covenant of salt?
A covenant of salt. Again, salt is preserving that. And so we have a cutting of a covenant. We have the idea of the communion that comes from the cutting of the covenant in eating together, as well as the idea of preservation that comes through the salting. We want to keep it preserved. We want to keep it from spoiling. All of these ideas enter tied up in this word covenant. These are all ideas that we should have in mind then when we talk about God voluntarily condescending. We shouldn't be surprised that in all of these covenanting episodes in the Bible, whether under the Old Testament or the New, what do we see? We see not only the establishing of the covenant, but it's usually attended with some kind of a ceremonial feasting and a concern that it be preserved, that the covenant be kept entire intact. Now, the word that, the Hebrew word berith in Greek, Greek refers to covenant as diatheke. Septuagint, in fact, uses the word diatheke to translate berith. The fact is that in the New Testament, it's translated as either covenant or testament. We'll talk about that more in a couple of weeks, in particular, the use of testament. There are a lot of people who deny that it is, in any sense, a testament. But, in fact, I think it's a very good word. There is no basis. In fact, it's contrary to the Greek writers, the Septuagint, and several texts in the New Testament, for insisting that diatheke is not to be translated as covenant, but solely as testament. That is also an important fact. I think diatheke is being used particularly in the New Testament to point up something interesting and very much related to the nature of this revelation that we have from God. The Old Testament and a testament in general is a reference to a written instrument. Moses has given us that. Christ and the apostles have given us that. But underlying this diversity of testament, old and new, there is this idea of covenant. And should we neglect that idea of covenant in a very subtle manner, that idea it would undermine the covenant transaction with God and the exercise of faith. It would take away from the continuity that we should see between the Old and New Testaments. It would take away the idea that lies under or behind the concept of the Old and New Testament, that this covenant that's being represented here is in fact a covenant that's there because of the voluntary condescension of God. This isn't simply a matter of Moses sitting down and writing the Bible and saying, hey, here's the Old Testament, or the apostles sitting down and writing the New Testament. There is underlying all of this the truth and the fact that God is entering into and expressing himself toward man by way of covenant. There's a voluntary condescension. He's revealing himself. He's revealing himself not only in nature, that is, as your creator, but also as our redeemer. Now, that idea of our redeemer has taken on a much broader added dimension when we consider the matter of sin. But even from the beginning with the covenant of works, God has voluntarily condescended in the covenant of works to promise a blessing of reward. You know, the creator-creature distinction is always saying to us simply this: do this. When that is subsumed under covenant, particularly the covenant of works, it takes on this form: do this and live. Do this and be blessed. And find your reward in me. So we don't want to look at Diatheke simply in terms of testament. On the other hand, we need to be very careful, as we'll see in a couple of weeks, that we don't neglect the testamentary idea either. Right now we're concerned about this idea of covenant, so that we really have fixed in our minds this idea that God is voluntarily condescending. This is a voluntary condescension on the part of our Creator. Now, the difference, among others, between the testament and covenant is that in the making of a testament, there's no permission needed from the heir. Whereas mutual acquiescence of both parties is a necessary prerequisite to a covenant. So, this is another thing that is, I think, why in the New Testament we see this shift in emphasis a little bit. It makes more clear in some respects, as we think of it as a testament, It makes more clear the unilateral imposition of God voluntarily condescending. So the Diatheke is most certainly very suitable to describe the covenant of grace, because on the one hand, it is a voluntary condescension of God. It's not us really participating. It's a covenant, then, which has an element of a testament in it. And it's a testament which has something of a covenant in it. We can call it a covenantal testament or testamental covenant. It doesn't really matter. Both ideas are involved there, and we'll talk about that more in a couple of weeks. What's important is this, that no matter how we're looking at it, we always keep in mind that this is God's voluntary condescension. There would be no possibility of blessedness in God or receiving of reward had God not taken upon himself to enter into this covenant arrangement. We would find ourselves in a situation simply, again, of facing a demand with no prospect of reward. Because after all, you're still going to be an unprofitable servant, even if you hadn't fallen into sin. Even if man hadn't fallen. If you were simply to do everything God commanded you to do, naturally, morally, all you've done is what was required. That's simply the debt of existence, being a dependent, existent being. You couldn't move from that and say, oh, you owe me something here. You know, I did this much. Having a good grasp of this is the first step in being disabused of any notion of the merits of saints, works of supererogation that the Roman Church puts forth and all of that. Right. You need to understand then that there is, in fact, this very real distinction between the Creator and the creation. And the only reason that we have any ground of expectation is covenant. And covenant is God voluntarily condescending. Now, in our language, covenant is derived from the verb to bind, whereby things which previously were not connected are joined together and united. In a covenant, then, parties which previously were not one, but existed separately, are bound together and thus united. And again, this is exactly what we see here, right? This is exactly what's going on. We have a divine being and a human being. They're not connected. There's no natural point of union or connection. How are they going to be brought together? At what point can these two different parties be bound together? Again, this points up the problem and why it has to be God's voluntary condescension. We can't of ourselves take hold on God. We can't demand that He enter into a covenant with us. We can't say, "Oh Lord, now you must come down and interact with us in this way, and when we've done X, Y, and Z, we demand to be paid." If God didn't voluntarily condescend, there would be no possibility of binding this together. There would be no meeting of the minds, if you will. This is also part of our utter dependence, the fact that God has to voluntarily condescend in order for us to be placed in a position beyond the expectation of that is due because we are creatures, you know, the expectation of a bare obedience. Right. The Greek diatheke also signifies an establishment, particularly one by agreement or testament. Hebrews 7:22 and 9:15.
Hebrews 7, verse 22. By so much was Jesus made a surety of a better testament.
Hebrews 9, verse 15. And for this cause, he is the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the First Testament, they which are called might receive the promise of eternal inheritance.
It's important here again, there is an agreement, an establishment that's being talked about here, generally speaking in Hebrews. Diatheke is better understood there, in fact, in terms of testament, because testament, testamental covenant, that's an idea of a covenant which is established in writing. That there is a written, what in the world of probate we would call a codicil to a will. There is a written appendix to it, whereby this is the thing that joins the desire of the testator. We'll talk about this more in a few weeks, to the law. It makes it part of the law. It becomes law. You know, what you decree in your will becomes law. It has the effect of law when you die. This is what I want done. So there's an establishing that's going on of this covenant. But really in Hebrews, it's talking about two different testamentary establishments of the one covenant of grace. And some of the verses we're going to look at in a moment at the end here, these verses all are really, or at least most of them, are primarily referencing the difference between the Old and the New Testament, rather than what we would call the covenant of works and the covenant of grace. And yet, because of the way the Old Testament was framed, it was and is considered a legal dispensation of the covenant of grace. So that, in fact, it holds forth in a peculiar way that broken covenant of works to people who are under a covenant of grace. Whereas the New Testament is focused more on the covenant of grace and what follows. Moses is focused on the covenant of grace and what preceded the giving of the covenant of grace. He's making that clear. So there's a legal dispensation of that covenant of grace here, but it's still the same covenant of grace. We'll see that as we go through this chapter. We're still talking about the same covenant of grace. All right, a real covenant in general is this then: an agreement made between different persons on certain terms. We've got two different parties. We've got terms or conditions. It's necessary then, it's necessary requisites are, in fact, parties, a condition, a promise, and a penalty, if any of these, the parties are fallible. So, when you have a covenant, you have the parties who are entering into the covenant, you establish the condition upon which that covenant is being enacted. The covenant also has annexed to it both a promise and a penalty. Now, where did the promise and penalty come from? Is that promise and penalty inherent in either party? No. Promise and penalty are inherent in the covenant. The fact is that either party brings to that covenant their existing assets or liabilities. In the case of God, it's only asset. In the case of man after the fall, it's only liability. But even in the case of man prior to the fall, it really is only a liability. It's a different kind of liability. It's not one yet subject to penalty because man hasn't failed. Hasn't failed with respect to the moral law. But the penalties that are annexed in terms of the covenant are covenant penalties. And so these are penalties, there are certain penalties which exist solely, not by reason of nature, the debt of nature that man has, it's expressed by the moral law, but there are penalties which man is subject to by reason of the debt of covenant. The covenant held forth promise, but it also held forth liability, penalty. One or both parties were to fail with respect to the covenant, then the penalty kicks in. On the other hand, if the parties involved are keeping the covenant, then the promises are in force. A lag of the one is a lag in the other. You know, a failure in the one calls for the penalty. Performance calls forth the promise. Right, the covenants which God has contracted for promoting the eternal welfare or happiness of mankind are two, of works and of grace. We want to look at Galatians 4.24, Romans 3.27, Galatians 2.21, and 5.4, Romans 6.14, Romans 8.2, and Philippians 3.9.
Galatians 4, verse 24, which things are an allegory, for these are the two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which genereth to bondage, which is Agar.
Romans 3, verse 27. Where is boasting then? It is excluded. By what law? Of works? Nay, but by the law of faith.
Galatians 2, verse 21. I do not frustrate the grace of God, for if righteousness come by the law, then Christ is dead in vain.
Galatians 5, verse 4. Christ has become of no effect unto you. Whosoever of you are justified by the law, ye are fallen from grace.
Romans 6:14. For sin shall not have dominion over you, for ye are not under the law, but under grace.
Romans 8:2. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus hath made me free from the law of sin and death.
Philippians 3, verse 9. And be found in him, not having my own righteousness, which is of the law, but that which is through the faith of Christ, the righteousness which is of God by faith.
Okay, now these are pointing up something. Again, the Old Testament dispensation, the Mosaic dispensation, is a legal dispensation of the covenant of grace. It's typical, it's shadowy. The New Testament dispensation is, in fact, not typical or shadowy. It's spiritual, it's in the fullness of the truth. And yet, it's possible, even though we're talking about a covenant of grace, and it was more possible because of the typical nature of the Mosaic administration, it was more possible to be confused on this point. But it's possible to try to turn the covenant of grace into a covenant of works. Now, the covenant of works, which was made by Adam in the garden, as we'll see, that was broken. And that really does not, it's not something that any man can fix. It's over. And original sin, the imputation of Adam's guilt and the transmission of native depravity, all of that is bound up and tied to this breach of the covenant of works. But when we approach the covenant of grace, when we do so, stepping out first in the form, when our attention is drawn first to the form rather than the substance of it, when we in fact look at it as something that begins with do rather than believe, we're turning, or we're attempting to turn the covenant of grace into a covenant of works. That's not that. It's never going to work that way. Which is why, again and again, the people in the Old Testament and Christ himself has this argument going on with the Pharisees and the Jews, the scribes. They tended to focus on the do before the believe. The covenant of works was really tied up in this. This do and live. And in living, do. That is to say, there was a condition of the covenant of works, not to eat of the tree. And in the keeping of that, they were still to keep the moral law. In the covenant of grace, we're told this: believe and live and do. So that we first believe in Christ, We find life not through the obedience of the first Adam, but through the obedience of the second Adam. Not through the will of the natural man, but through the will of the God-man. And in that, we then find new obedience. But in either equation, the keeping of the moral law is subsequent to the imposition of the covenant, the keeping of the covenant condition, and the exercise and really the fruition of the covenant, either in way of promise or in a way of punishment or penalty. So there are only two covenants that God has made with man, a covenant of works and a covenant of grace. And the one thing I want you to be clear about right now is this, and we'll talk about this more as this chapter unfolds. The covenant of works is not the covenant that was made with Moses. The Mosaic covenant was also the covenant of grace, an imposition of the covenant of grace. It was a legal dispensation, but it was nonetheless a dispensation of the covenant of grace. Yeah.
Is that why some dispensationalists say that the Old Testament saints were saved by works?
Yes. It's a total misunderstanding of the nature of the Bible, the covenant of grace, the way that God saves men after they become sinners. The period of the covenant of works in place and actually possible ends with the fall of Adam. And so although we see that, and we also see hints of what that entailed when we see men trying, because of sin, to turn back to and resurrect the covenant of works out of the covenant of grace, which is why Paul talks this way and recognizes that this is, in fact, a peculiar perversion that was especially a problem under the Old Testament or Mosaic dispensation of the covenant of grace, because it was a legal dispensation, because it did have such a close association with law. It was very easy for them to become confused, if they were unbelievers, into thinking that there was a covenant of works reimposed, and if we just do this, we'll be saved. They forget that, as the catechisms point out, there's a preface to the Ten Commandments, which is, I'm the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt, therefore. In other words, redemption always precedes, or grace always precedes, the keeping of the law in the covenant of grace. And that's exactly how we know Moses had a dispensation of the covenant of grace, because grace is, in fact, preceding that. Grace is a motivating factor. We're not without the law, as Paul says, but we're under the law to Christ. We're not antinomians, but we're not saved by the works of the law. Good works follow. We should not become antinomians, and we shouldn't, in fact, be concerned to, or we shouldn't allow ourselves to fall into the trap of fulfilling the caricature of Romanism, that Protestantism disavows any necessity of good works. Not true. Good works are necessary to salvation, but they're not part of our justification before God. We're not justified by the works of the law. That idea is a covenant of works idea that keeps trying to creep back in. It was because, again, because of the way that the Mosaic covenant, the Mosaic dispensation of the covenant grace was administered, it was certainly easier, should men persist in unbelief, to become confused on that point. But it's not really the way that we should view that. It wasn't a covenant of works. It wasn't a republication of the covenant of works. Because, in fact, the covenant of works was broken when man fell. It's also an error, as we'll see, to confuse the covenant of works with the moral law. The moral law is not the covenant of works. The moral law, natural moral law, is that debt that we owe to the Creator by reason of being His creation. But the covenant of works and the covenant of grace are expressions of that voluntary condescension of God toward His creature, which creates that that possibility of not only serving God, but serving God happily with a prospect of blessedness in Him and a reward. So those are some of the things that we need to keep in mind as we consider the matter of covenant. We'll move on next time and begin to talk about the covenant of works. And from there, we'll then talk about the covenant of grace and the distinctions in the covenant of grace between the Old and New Testaments and so on. So the chapter deals with a lot of different subjects, but those are some things we need to avoid if we would think aright about this. Next time, we'll take up the covenant of works.